From KCRW in Santa Monica, this is The Treatment.
It's The Treatment. I'm Elvis Mitchell. You can also hear the show at KCRW.com. As a director, Jon Favreau has taken films that are about transition, about basically boy-men moving into being men. If you look at his first film as writer, Swingers, to his film as writer-director, Maid, and certainly Zathura, he's done that as well. And in his new film, Iron Man, he gets into that same kind of category. Jon, welcome to the show.
Thank you.
But I would say the last three movies you made as a director, between Elf, Zathura, and Iron Man, all fall pretty squarely into that kind of mythology, don't they?
Yeah. I think when you're making a movie, you got to fall back on the old, you know, the whole Joseph Campbell hero's journey. I think you need a roadmap. And why not pick the best roadmap that there is? It works for the Bible. It works for, you know, Homer's poems. It works for great films. And, you know, and so I know enough to know what to use as my guiding force through it. And you have to constantly look back and see if you're telling a story in the proper structure, in the proper way. And once you give it that spine, you could add as much detail, or you could play with the dialogue, the humor, special effects. All those things are just adornments to the basic structure of story.
Well, if you look at Iron Man, Stan Lee's original conception, mm-hmm. it's both Frankenstein mm-hmm. and the Man in the Iron Mask. It's two of those kinds of myths, isn't it?
Yeah, it truly is. And I think that you never get a purer shot at doing an archetype story than you will with a superhero film, because it's a stylized hero. It is a hero. You acknowledge it. Everything has to be a hero story, even if it's even Swingers in its own way, or Wizard of Oz, or any of those small stories about small lead characters. In their own reality, they are a hero that comes of age.
But you talk about that sort of that kind of character death, and that really happens in Swingers too with your character. It really is. He has to pass through that thing to become the man he's going to be.
That's right. And we talked about it in those terms. I mean, I would never talk about it unless it came up in a situation like this with you. That's not part of – I don't think that people have to understand that consciously to be able to appreciate the story on some deeper level. But ultimately, I want to tell stories that where you go through hardship and it ends up with a hopeful message as you're sort of reborn and see the world as a place where you can persevere. And I think that the personality of the filmmaker tends to come out in their work, especially when they have a body of work. You could start to see what's in common among those films. And I've never really – and I come from indies. You know, we both – we were on the Spirit Awards committee together. We go back a long way. And I remember from watching all those films on that committee that there are some people who use independent films to tell stories that are dark, that are not commercial, won't make money because that's what's going on in their head. And then there are other people that use independent films to tell stories that are basically traditional stories but on a much smaller scale because that's what they have available to them. And you see as those filmmakers that – used independent films as their sort of film school, as they graduate to big movies like this, that storytelling, those chops that you get from that experience seems to translate well if you look at Chris Nolan, Peter Jackson, Sam Raimi. That whole generation of filmmaker are now the people who are making these popcorn movies that actually have value in them. And they're embraced by commercial audiences, but you don't get the sense that they feel like they're playing in an area that they don't want to. There was always like a resentment when I was first coming up, before my generation hit the big movies, that people would do one for me, one for them, that they resented the big movies. But my generation grew up on Star Wars and Spielberg's movies, and there were good popcorn movies that you always dreamed of making yourself, and it never felt like you were betraying your art by making those movies.
Well, but also, the other thing about those films that you're talking about between Lucas and Spielberg is when those movies were coming out, nobody had any idea how big they were going to be. I mean, you know, Star Wars is kind of a joke. That's why Fox gave Lucas the merchandise.
Right. I just read that. Do you ever read that book, The Making of Star Wars? There's a great new book out. It's been about for maybe a year.
Uh-huh.
And what's interesting about that is you're absolutely right. Everybody wrote that story off. It was like a weird, quirky thing. There was no source material. He used that movie and he had no resources. And what was interesting is everything seemed to go wrong on that film. And he was constantly rewriting and changing and compromising and the effects weren't working. Same thing with Jaws, by the way.
Oh, sure.
But because there was that sort of Jungian archetypal story going on, and he was so religious to that storytelling that it seemed to capture everybody's fancy. And then on top of that, you had the state of the art, you know, at the time, the motion control spaceship battles.
It reinvented special effects.
But without it, remember, there was a lot of movies. I mean, if it was only the special effects, then the black hole would have been – we would have been talking about that now.
Let's not.
And we're not.
We should say it's the treatment. My guest is Jon Favreau. His new movie as a director, you may have heard of it, is Iron Man. But it's funny, too. We're talking about this kind of debasement because Stan Lee used to say that he used the name Stan Lee because he had his big plan to go write novels.
Uh-huh. And so he was nom de plume.
Yes. He's kind of his pseudonym using the name Stan Lee. And
that's
sort of taking all these literary tropes that he himself loved. You look at the Hulk, which is the Gollum, among other things.
That's right.
And Iron Man. They have all these kind of literary antecedents to them.
If we actually had a still frame from the Gollum up on the wall, the old film.
Yeah,
the silent film. And this is Iron Man actually follows that archetype a lot, about the man creating the suit. You know, in the case of the Gollum, it's the, you know, whatever, the rabbi in Prague building this
statue.
This statue out of clay and then inscribing the name of God across his forehead, and then him coming to life and saving the village from the persecutors. So that's it's a very ancient myth, and there's a little bit of Joseph from the Old Testament in this too. And I was always trying to look for little things to give me guidance as to how to tell the story. You'll never really see it in the movie, but it at least clarified what story we were telling.
Well, so much of the movie takes place in these villages, though. I mean, and that, when you talk about the Gollum, that's very much a part of kind of biblical storytelling, the way you use the villagers.
Yeah.
And then this Iron Man is kind of this sort of Damocles in some ways.
Which was important because it was a potentially very divisive movie because we wanted to set it in today's, in the
context
of today.
Say the original story of Iron Man is Tony Stark. In those days, millionaire industrialists. That's how far back it goes. God, maybe even Indochina.
Pre-Vietnam. It was the early 60s. We were right on the cusp of Vietnam, and it was dealing with the communist threat in Indochina.
He's a munitions manufacturer and inventor who's injured, and to save himself and his heart, builds a suit out of iron, the old big iron.
Right.
It's amazing how much of the Iron Man mythology you squeeze into.
Yeah.
It's almost no place left to go in some ways.
There's forward. You know, there's a lot of stories. I mean, fortunately with Iron Man, people have the iconic images of the suit, but the storylines aren't really that well known compared to other superheroes. So it gave us a tremendous freedom in storytelling.
I have to say one thing you did that I think is, the great moment, almost like a moment on a silent film, is during the operation where you realize, and it's something that never occurred to me because I must have been like 5 or 6 years old when I saw the comics, this is a guy who's being operated on, heart surgery with no anesthesia.
Yeah,
that's
yeah.
truly a terrifying moment.
Yeah, we really wanted to make that, just take him from, sort of the first image I had was the carefree guy joking around in a Humvee going through Afghanistan in a suit, drinking a scotch with soldiers, and you think that it's going to be a silly film. And then, boom, an IED goes off and he wakes up and he's in a hostage video. And, if you've lived and read newspapers and looked at CNN for the last, whatever it is, 5, 7 years, those images are very chilling. And just to make that leap from one end of the spectrum to the other. And I think kids, what's nice is little kids don't really understand the significance, but the parents kind of do of that imagery. And we're able to walk that fine line where it's appropriate for younger people, but yet if you're an adult and you could read into it what the social context is of the whole film, it doesn't just exist in Metropolis or Gotham City. And that's always been the strength of Marvel.
For the most part, they existed in New York until the 80s probably.
Yeah. And I lived in New York, so I knew I grew up in Forest Hills, and Peter Parker was from Forest Hills. And they would draw the city streets, and I would be able to look at, hey, that's the, Unisphere across the street from my house, and that's – and they lived in the real world. They had real problems. And it was always a weird subversive tone to it that was almost a reaction to the DC comics, much like the Warner Brothers Bugs Bunny movies was a reaction at the time to the Disney movies.
Sure.
And it was real groundbreaking stuff at the time. And I found that the Marvel films, because of the effects and the scale and the budget, have taken on this epic tone. And that was never the tone of the books. And being that we were the first Marvel Studios movie, I really wanted to preserve that tone. And so Downey in this is seen as, what an interesting casting choice. How against the grain? Well, not really. That's kind of exactly the guy that Tony Stark was presented as in those books, if you take it in the context of the time.
Oh, sure. It's the treatment, I guess, a director and actor Jon Favreau. His new film is Iron Man. But that fascinates me too, because I wonder, part of the fun, and we've all heard the stories about how Downey had, you had to fight to get him into the movie,
yeah.
is having him basically be what we think of as Robert Downey Jr. Yeah. at the beginning of the movie. I mean, that had to be a little bit of the fun for you when that finally did click into place.
It was, because there's something really interesting if you mix reality and movie making in the right, in the proper measures. You get – sometimes it backfires on you. I think Zhili backfires a little bit you know what I mean?
Yeah.
Jennifer Lopez and Affleck, where it takes away from the movie. I mean, like with Swingers, we inherited tremendous goodwill because the story of the movie was the story of the movie. The movie was turned into the movie. The life turned into the movie, and there was a – it was sort of embraced as something that was bigger than a film, because it was a very small film, and it was only appreciated over time.
Now, you were telling me before we started that it did much better in its afterlife on DVD than the afterlife, which I didn't know.
No, it made like 5 million, and most people would never guess that based on how many people have seen it and what type of impact it's had.
Well, I think certainly if you live here, which I did at the time that the movie played, it was everywhere here.
It was a big thing. But you know, it played you know, when we were in Italy playing it in the Venice Film Festival, it seemed to strike a chord there too. So there was something universal about it. But the fact was that the actors were the characters in a weird way, which was the movie. That's part of, I think, what people appreciated about it. And I think with the casting of Robert in this, you really don't have to go that far with Tony Stark. You know, we don't really show that much. It's definitely a clean movie. But yet he might throw a glance, say something, you know, sort of under his breath. And all of a sudden, the grown-ups in the audience read his whole experience that they've seen play out in the news, gets read into Tony Stark. And it makes – you know, and we've been enjoying good reviews, and I think a lot of them are attributed to the fact that people are just digging what he's doing in this film, because he really does – I mean, it's one of the only comic book movies I could think of where the actor upstages the suit.
Because of the problem with so much of these movies is that so much builds towards the suit that we don't have any idea of who inhabits the suit.
Right.
It's like that Spider-Man or Batman or whomever is a different person. And we know that Tony Stark is the same. And you even make this sort of – in the script there's – because for years in the comic, you know, Iron Man was his bodyguard.
Right.
Which was probably like the least believable alter ego of all time.
Which we sort of tip a hat to at the end, yeah.
Yeah, you tip a hat to a lot of the mythology. And it's and that's really fascinating because it's done in a lot of – it's really done in throwaway fashion.
It is, because you want to have enough there for the fans, but you don't want to have so much there that the non-fans, which is 99% of your audience, is going to be thrown off by it or feel like it's not for them. But being that this was the first Marvel film –
when you say by Marvel film, you mean Marvel financed this instead of having the studio finance and putting its name on it as a production.
They created Marvel Studios. They had money from Merrill Lynch. They had whatever – however hundreds of millions of dollars to make so many movies. And they were going to control the rights, and they were going to be distributed by Paramount. In the past, they, you know, Spider-Man was at Sony, Fox did X-Men. So now, since it was theirs, you know, when they first announced this deal, the LA Times is like, Marvel has their own studio and they're parading out their B-list heroes. Does anybody care? But because we aimed it at the fans and we brought footage to Comic-Con a year ago, and it just so happens that I know that, like, when we first met, the festival circuit independent films were where the buzz sort of started in the movie industry. And if you look at the way the Oscars went, you look at what films broke through, the independent film world was where the grassroots of the buzz began.
She was like the AAA team of the film world.
Right. And it felt like more than that, because somehow it cut through the press and it captured the fancy of people who love movies, and they sort of looked to that. And that was where the news came out of, and that was picked up by, you know, Vanity Fair, Entertainment Weekly, and slowly percolated up through the mainstream press. But now, because of the internet, it seems that like this whole geek culture is really permeating and creating the buzz, and that's where the fuse gets lit on a lot of these films. And so by going to Comic-Con and winning them over with, hey, this is the right guy to play Tony Stark. Here's the footage. This is a suit built by Stan Winston. You're looking at all practical effects except for the end. And ILM is doing a good job with this, and we're staying true to what you guys love about Tony Stark. That began the conversation. That began the YouTube bootlegs and the reviews online and the buzz. And then that slowly grew over the course of last year to the mainstream. But it was that audience that we knew we had to hit first because they were the ones who were going to either anoint us or tell us that we were the next, you know, Catwoman.
And on that note, we'll take a break. My guest is director Jon Favreau, whose new film as director is Iron Man. I'm Elvis Mitchell. This is The Treatment.
You're listening to The Treatment with Elvis Mitchell from the studios of KCRW Santa Monica.
Welcome back. It's The Treatment, which you can also hear at KCRW.com. My guest is director and actor Jon Favreau. He's an actor in the movie Iron Man as well as being its director. But we go back to almost 20 years now with Tim Burton doing Batman, which there was some fan abrasion about, and the idea of Michael Keaton playing Batman, which there's real fan distaste towards. If you feel in some ways that sort of helped break ground for a little bit for where you are now with this.
I think there were a lot of people that sort of came before me and opened different doors. Burton certainly with the idea that you could catch everybody's fancy with a movie like this. Because I read the Dark Knight graphic novels.
The Dark Knight Returns.
But I never was a Batman comic book guy other than that. So I don't know that I was squarely in the comic book geek audience at that time. But when I saw Nicholson in that makeup in the trailer, I was like, I got to see this movie. And everybody felt the same way. And that's really what introduced me to Burton. I guess he had done Pee Wee before then, which I knew and liked. But I didn't associate that with a Tim Burton film. It was through that film that Tim Burton became Tim Burton in my eyes.
But in his way, he's what you're talking about. You talked about the indie world or the world outside of the mainstream.
Yeah.
He brought a sensibility that was definitely not mainstream to a movie like that. And I think you and sort of coming in that tradition are doing the same thing. But not only you directing this movie, but having Downey in it and Jeff Bridges, who 30 years ago might have been Tony Stark for a while.
Right.
And Gwyneth Paltrow and Terrence Howard.
Nolan opened that door more than Burton. He's more of a filmmaker than I am, I have to say.
How do you mean that?
He's visual. He's a movie guy. I'm an actor. But there's like him. There's Guillermo del Toro. These people are in a different category than me. They just make movies from a different place. I'm a fan. I love the effects. I love obsessing and learning and doing and trying things and try to blow people's minds. There's a sense of relish that Tarantino has when he makes a movie where it's almost like he's making a mixtape for a friend. Like they're going to love this. Oh, this will really get the party going. And it's more of you're like a showman and you're telling a story and you're trying to get – it's more like being a comic on stage. It's more like being a performer except you're using the movie to do it. But I would spend half the day sometimes in the trailer talking with Robert because we had to get the scene just right for the characters. Or what's he going to say to Gwyneth? Or this, I don't believe this. And that kills half of your day. There are other directors who are setting up shots and boards. And now there were certain things like the action where you had to give it its due and it became about that. And there were no actors on the set. And we really composed it and used storyboards and animatics and all the things that a real filmmaker would use. But when it came to the actors, we had two cameras going. We encouraged improvisation. We would rewrite, you know, on the backs of the sides and hand it over and try things to give it some life and some reality and chemistry and a light touch.
It's The Treatment, I guess, of director Jon Favreau. We're talking about films, but his new film is director is Iron Man. What you're talking about is still creating an emotional reality.
That's right.
Even though it's a fantastical setting, which is what you do want to do clearly with Iron Man.
That's the bottom line. I mean, you hit it on the head. It is an emotional medium. You must maintain an emotional reality. There are more laughs in a Quentin Tarantino film or a Scorsese film than in a goofy movie because you're creating tension and a reality. And anytime you break that tension or that reality, you get a laugh of relief. And with the superhero films, there's different ways to go. Fantastic Four did well. But they throw one-liners out. You sometimes forget the reality in it. Now, my kid loves it. But for me, I wanted to tell a story that felt a little bit more based in reality. And there are several tones you can choose from the array of superhero movies that you have now. I wanted to aspire to what Nolan was doing with Batman Begins, but yet have a certain playfulness and freedom that I don't think that that film had. That was much more of a gothic movie. I wanted this one to feel a little bit more fun, a little bit less important.
And it's actually more fun than the old Iron Man comics were, which were like constant soap opera. At the end of every issue, he was clutching his heart trying to plug his recharger for it. And you even have a bit of that. That's kind of a big sort of moment. Because you always worry about, was it ever going to be enough power to get something done?
Right. Well, because there's no balance to the character otherwise, because he could lift up a building and he could, you know, fly the speed of sound and all that stuff. But to find that proper tone is the key. And I never like – I like having humor, but the humor can never dissipate the stakes of the moment or the emotional reality of the film. And that's been the case in whether it was Swingers or Maid or Elf or this. Hopefully, you know, that's a through line.
But there's also – in all these movies too, because they're really about that sort of transition. Are you going to be a grown-up or not?
Yeah.
Literally, in Zathura, that's that. But there's a kind of melancholy in all these movies.
Yeah. Yeah.
And you must have worried about being able – you're talking about shifting tones. Throughout Iron Man, is that constant sort of feeling of that.
Yeah, I was worried that we were going too far with the comedy sometimes. Like I wrote the scene. There's a scene where Gwyneth Paltrow comes in and he's switching out his heart. And we go kind of broad with it. I had Stan Winston build a false chest so that Gwyneth could stick her like whole hand into his chest when she's changing out his heart.
And she plays his executive assistant.
Yes, and possible love interest. And she's sticking her arm into his body, and I wanted that to be the humor of it, and then them both play it totally real with that sight gag. And I wrote like a nice, fun, meet-cute scene, which, you know, those are the types of scenes I could spit out pretty easily from my background with Swingers and stuff, and that kind of dialogue
scene.
And also
your background in improv comedy too.
Improv comedy. You know, more so than certainly the superhero fighting dialogue. That's really hard for me to get a handle on.
But at a certain point, that's kind of meaningless stuff. I mean, because we know the hero's going to win, so you've got to build the emotional stakes in other parts, don't you?
I think so, you know. But you wonder if you go too far with the humor that you can get them back for, is this guy going to live or not? And I was amazed at how much latitude that I had, and it still felt – I mean, the fans still accepted it, and it didn't feel too far. I always sort of shoot safeties where – you don't go as far. But it's amazing sometimes if you have people emotionally what you can get away with. And humor and laughter really forgives you so much. And if you notice, all the action sequences end with something unexpected that takes the piss out of the movie a little bit. And look, I've been making movies the same with the same basic tone my whole career. And only now – and sometimes it's accepted and sometimes it's not. Fortunately, in this case, because of who the cast was, the way it was supported by Paramount – the freedom we were given by Marvel, it seemed to hit some weird good chord with what people wanted to see, what the politics of the day were, the escapism of it, the state-of-the-art special effects between Winston and ILM that had done all that work on Transformers. To use that and be able to use that in the minutiae of the suit really gave it more details and layers and something – and you know from movies, you see enough of them. Sometimes they work, sometimes they don't. And a lot of times it's not up to you whether it does or not. You got to get lucky, and we got lucky on this one.
It's the treatment. I'm talking to director John Favreau. His new film is Iron Man. But as you're talking about that, what I'm curious about, because there are enough things that you built in to please the fans between the Iron Man ringtone and the S.H.I.E.L.D. stuff, which
we can't
give too much of that away. Uh-huh. But also, in terms of the emotional terms, I just wonder for you if you felt like this is the right time for you to make this movie, that maybe you couldn't have made this movie 5 years ago. That you had grown up enough as a director and understood enough of this sort of the difficulties technically after Zathura to do a film like this.
Yeah, it is interesting. You know, you look back and it all seems like it makes sense. At the time, you're just doing what seems right. But the improv and the characters and the humor that I learned all that from Swingers and then Maid, and then what I learned based on comedy and marketing from Elf, and then what I learned about effects from Zathura, it all sort of came together here. And also the frustration of knowing that Zathura didn't really even have a name people could say to market it on, and that it just bombed so hard after I put so much care into it and thought it was a very commercial property when I was asked to do it.
You talked about the pieces about these being sort of B characters. With the exception of Spider-Man, you could think of almost every Marvel character as kind of a B character. I mean, a lot of the Marvel characters, with the exception of people who really love and know them, a lot of them aren't iconic in the same way the DC characters are. And I think they all work based on what the filmmaker brings to it. Did that actually make people nervous, a piece like that?
Yeah, because your bank, that's your $20 million star is the hero. That's why you have the freedom to cast who you want to. That's what's nice about it. I mean, honestly, the fact that it was a superhero movie gave me more freedom on this than I've ever had on a film creatively.
Yeah.
Because you don't need – you do a movie at this budget level. You normally need a box office face to launch it. Well, that face is the superhero. That face is Marvel. So now you're casting the best people for the movie. You're given that freedom. Also, nobody's questioning my comedy. Nobody's questioning my storytelling. There's no scrutiny. I was rewriting on the set. The producers were there. It was a small machine. So the studio and the producers were one and the same. They were there on the set. They were digging what we were doing. And I had complete freedom. It was the action that they were very careful about, because they knew that even if the movie didn't work between the suit scenes, if the action was good enough to cut together a great trailer and it was enough of a spectacle, they would make their money back.
Okay.
That's how they positioned this thing. And they've had great success with films that were well-reviewed and films that weren't. But I think that they love the idea of making a movie that's actually a good movie on top of a movie that was profitable. And that happens sometimes. That happened with a few of the Spider-Man movies. That happened with a few of the X-Men movies. It happened with Nolan's Batman and the original Batman, Superman.
But what happens at a certain point is that we're now – and you were getting at this a little bit earlier – a point in the culture where we have guys like you who grew up on these comics,
yeah,
and know – certainly, as a filmmaker, as an actor, you have enough sense to know what works in those different venues,
yeah,
to marry all these elements together, don't you?
I think so. I think you got to love it. I think you got to love the genre. You got to love what you're doing if you're going to do a good job. You know, ultimately, I'm sitting alone coming up with this stuff or with a small group of people. And then we put it out there in the world. And then for people to dig it and connect with it, you feel this tremendous sense of communion. And now it just wraps all the way around the world. And there's something really gratifying and almost spiritual in that feeling that this is something very personal that you felt strongly about, that you're sharing, and it's affecting other people's lives in a positive way. That's the big buzz you get off of this stuff. That's the big kick.
But you also have the thing, too, that most directors don't get is you still have an acting career.
I kind of do. I mean, I'll do films, but that's definitely not my day job. You know, my day job is making movies now, and that's where it's led. And I did Swingers to try to be an actor, and that led to writing, which led to directing, which led to this. So you're in this big Hollywood rat maze, and then when a little trap door opens, you got to go through it, and it will lead you to another chamber and another room with other opportunities. And I think if there's anything that I've been good at, it's been being realistic about where I was in my career, what opportunities were facing me, not getting frustrated and always looking for a way to do something that I was passionate about. I try not to lose that feeling of, boy, would I love to do this for a living.
That's really great to hear, John. Thanks so much for doing this.
It's a real treat.
Oh, it's really my pleasure. Come back in anytime you want.
Thank you.
My guest is John Favreau, actor and director. His new film is Iron Man. Our technical director and editor is Bob Carlson. Gemma Dempsey's the producer. I'm Elvis Mitchell. I don't have a heart of steel. It's The Treatment.
An audio archive of this and other programs can be found at kcrw.com. For questions and comments about The Treatment, please email us at thetreatment@kcrw.com. The Treatment is produced and distributed by KCRW Santa Monica.